oftentimes it's better to start with creativity to help you learn the facts.
Life is too short to learn a list of 1,000 rando words.
From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In with your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I am with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise, at the hardest times, Pope.
Denise at the hardest times, huh?
Yeah. Today we're going to be talking about grief.
Yes, we are going to be talking about grief and really how to support kids and young adults as they are going through this, because it affects all parts of our lives.
So one thing I lament in a lot of current American society is the lack of ritual.
Hmm.
So grief is when you really want ritual. You want a set of routines that you follow that help you through the period. So I want to tell the story of the ritual in this village I lived in Alaska. So this was very remote, Athabascan village, no roads in or out, and a lot of death up there. You know, it's a hard life. And so someone might die, say Kenny dies, and they largely sit Shiva. Right.
Okay, so let's explain what that is to listeners who don't know.
So you explain.
Okay, so sitting Shiva is where, from the Jewish religion, you for 7 days are supposed to really stop doing everything. You don't go to work. People come and visit you. They bring you food. You don't. You're not supposed to pay attention to how you look, put on makeup, you cover the mirrors. You're supposed to really focus on thinking about and the wonderful memories of the deceased.
So. During this time, people would come from other villages. They would take a snowmobile up or fly in and provide support to the grieving family. And then there's a burial. It's very sad. The unique thing is about 3 years, 4 years later, they have what's called a stick dance. And so this stick dance is for all the people who have passed away in the last 3 or 4 years. They have one large event. And this is the biggest ritual in this community. And during the stick dance, they all come in and there's a stick, a large stick, and there's a hall, an octagon-shaped hall. And people walk around this stick all night and they sing these 12 sacred songs. The sacred songs are in a different language, so nobody's quite sure what they're saying. It's incredibly moving. And during this time, the family that was helped during their time of grief now gives things back to the people who helped them. Guns, jackets, beaded mukluks.
Are these things that the deceased owned?
No. These are usually new. They sew them during the year, for example.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, on an evolutionary side, it's a way to redistribute wealth.
Right.
But
it's a thank you gift, basically.
It is. It's a thank you gift. So this goes on all night. It's very haunting. I still remember it 40 years from now. I've been to a few of them. And then in the morning, they break the stick and throw it in the Yukon River.
Wow.
So it's a great celebration. So in the morning, the first time this happened, a guy came that I knew, Ducks, who was one of the people they had dressed because he had helped when Kenny died.
So they gave him a thank you gift of a jacket or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And he came over and the jacket, he had a hood on, and he comes in and I go, Ducks, it's good to see you. And he says, I'm not Ducks, I'm Kenny. This is your chance to say last words to me.
So Kenny was the deceased.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah,
he was
yeah,
pretending
yeah.
to be him.
Yeah.
And so that you could say goodbye.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
I don't remember what I said. You know, I was going to say,
what did you say?
Well, I think I probably said something like, damn. <You know? laughs> But it's a beautiful ritual. There's a lot of peace, a lot of thankful, a lot of pride and respect.
Was he going to everyone's house?
Yeah.
So they could say goodbye?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So ritual's good.
Ritual is good. Ritual is good in general. Ritual is good, particularly, I think, as you said, at time of death. And we are very lucky because we have an expert here, both in terms of ritual, but also particularly in terms of grief. And we are here with Rabbi Patricia Carlin Newman, who is the Senior Associate Dean for Religious Life at Stanford University. She teaches and lectures on Jewish feminism, rabbinical ethics, the relationship between religion and education, and social justice. And she helps the Stanford community grapple with really big questions: career, relationships, living a balanced life, and of course, grief, and particularly educating about grief. So, Patricia, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Dan, your story evokes two different thoughts for me. One is a friend from college who wrote a book called Remembering Lives, R-E-Membering. Mm-hmm. Her name is Lorraine Hedke. And what she suggests is that when people die, they were members of our community and they remain members of our community. Yeah. So part of what we need to do is transfer our understanding of how are they still part of our community even when they are no longer physically with us.
That's very insightful.
Yeah, I love that.
It's also a very clever title.
Yes, really good, really good.
And the other is a ritual that we do here at Stanford once a year called Honoring Lives, Remembering Losses. And it's one of the places where we invite the entire community to come together to light a candle, to say a word about the person that they're remembering, perhaps offer an anecdote, listen to music, do some writing. And we conclude it with offering people strawberries, because in the Ojibwe tradition, strawberries are heart fruit. Mm. So in the same way that you had the chance to say goodbye to Kenny and Docs was dressed in Kenny's clothing, there's a tradition of offering to the person who dies all of the things that they will need on their journey into the afterlife.
Oh, wow.
And the heart fruit is sort of the send-off gift.
Hmm. That's beautiful.
I love that.
So Stanford has a faculty senate. So these are representatives from all the departments and schools. And each one starts with someone reading a memorial resolution about a professor who has passed and all their accomplishments. And then the Senate stands up and, you know, there's 30 seconds of silence.
Pays tribute.
Yeah. It's very profound.
Yeah.
It's very academic, too, because the things they talk about is you publish this paper or you publish that paper.
Right.
You
know? It's not necessarily.
And then there's a sentence and he has a family.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we do the counterpart to that, which is the memorials for people who've died.
Right.
And we always try to have the arc of someone's life represented. So certainly what their academic and professional contributions have been, but also their family, their friends, what motivated them to be engaged in the work that they were. And there's often laughter. There's always tears.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that what links all of what we're talking about is that you can't walk the journey of grief alone. You need to be with other people. Mm. And for those of us who are part of a religious community, being with other people may have a kind of script for what ritual to do, how you move from death back to life. I was just meeting with someone who has been a mourner, and one of the things that we talked about is there is in the Jewish tradition, when you leave the gravesite, a gathering of the people who have come into two lines so that they can kind of pull you from the place of death back to the place of life, because you really can't do it on your own. Mm. And one of the things that I think of is I run a group that meets twice a quarter with students who have experienced loss. And for several years, for 5 years, while this student was both an undergraduate and then a co-term, was a young woman who had lost her brother right before she came to Stanford, the summer before she came to Stanford. And every time she would come to this group, she would share a little bit more about her brother. So I felt like I really knew him. And one day she called me after she'd graduated and said that she was getting married to her high school sweetheart, who she had been with when she'd gotten word of her brother's death, and asked if I would officiate at the wedding.
Aww.
And we didn't share a religious tradition, but we shared this common humanity and this experience of having been there for one another, and she had really been kind of the stalwart in this group. So I went to this community where everyone at the wedding had been there at the funeral. And there's a Psalms text which says, "You turn my mourning into dancing." And that was the text that I used. Mm. And the dancing was just exuberant.
Oh, that's so sweet.
This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. And we are speaking with Rabbi Patricia Carlin Newman about grief and educating people about grief, but really what we've been hearing so far is how to turn mourning into some kind of celebration and honoring. And can you tell a little bit more about what you do? I know you have a grief group that meets regularly. How did that get started, and what happens in those groups?
So I think that there was a desire for different parts of the university to come together. So the group is the Counseling and Psychological Services Office, the Office for Religious Life, Residential Education, Graduate Life Office, and Well-Being at Stanford. And we all recognized that we had different pieces of helping students to move through grief. So we came together, and initially the group was just inviting people to share what they were experiencing. But of course, at a place like Stanford, having the opportunity to learn, how do I help someone grieving, or how do I make sense of this experience, played a role in our shifting it to having a didactic section. So we talk a little bit about what are the issues that come up for people who are grieving, for students who are coming to campus, and let's say they've lost a parent. They're asked, what do your parents do? You know, they're then confronted with the question of, do I reveal that I'm a mourner and perhaps bring everybody down? I don't know that I want to reveal this quite yet. Or do I just kind of elide the question and answer it in a way that may feel like I'm erasing someone I love? So there are all kinds of complicated questions for students to make sense of when they're encountering friends. How much do I rely on the other people in my residence to help me through this? If there's a death on campus, which there has been, we gather together a group of people, often with some of those same offices involved, and try to create the time and place for students to reflect together, to share stories, in some cases to meet with family, and for the family to hear a little bit of what their life was like as a student at Stanford, to kind of round out their experience. So again, that notion of the arc of someone's life is very much present. And in all of the work that I do, I try to help people to recognize that there's no right way to grieve. One of the people that I recently officiated at a memorial for had a wife who said, "Stop shoulding on yourself," because we are so inclined to say, what should I be doing? How should I get through this? What's the proper period of time? When do I know that this is done? How do I move on? And then from the side of people who are trying to be helpful, what do I offer to do? Am I placing an extra burden on the person who's mourning by asking them what would be helpful? So those are all questions that we try to address with the students, and often really just creating the time and space for them to help one another, because someone who's been on this path for a little longer might have a lot of good ideas for a peer.
Nice. This is Schools In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz, and we're talking with Rabbi Patricia Carlin Newman, who's educating us about grief and the different stages and how it affects students at Stanford, but also all learners, really.
So these are things that one might do once grief has set in. As a parent, as a teacher, is there something I can do to prepare children for the eventuality of grief?
I think being far more honest than you might be inclined to be. I think children know when something's wrong. They know when someone's ill. They know when there's a shock to the system. And in a sense, by trying to protect them, part of what you're doing is closing off an avenue for them to be able to ask questions, to share what they're feeling, to understand something about the world. I encourage people to bring children to funerals and to memorials.
Really?
I think it's important for young people to understand that our lives are crafted with many different people and many different gifts. And often that is very apparent in those moments. And children feel their emotions very powerfully. So to preclude them from feeling pain is not helpful to them. And what we know about grief is it doesn't go away. It might go underground, but then it'll come and slap you in the face in a different way.
I don't mean to be too glib, but I had a goldfish that died in the classroom and that teacher told my parents, make sure he's the one who flushes it down the toilet so he can see the cycle of life.
We buried the goldfish. We buried the goldfish. They would kind of like jump into the sink and, you know, I don't know if that's considered suicide, but they would jump into the sink and then we would take them out and bury them. But it was the same thing. It was sort of to see the cycle of life and, you know, so, to fertilize the vegetables.
Flushing may be, it may have been too antiseptic.
One of the things that I often do, I meet with the students who are part of the Bridge, our peer counseling center, to speak with them about grief. And I start by inviting them to identify a variety of settings in which they've experienced loss or they've watched someone else experience loss. And it could be anything from going home on Thanksgiving and the relationship being over from high school.
Oh, yeah. To, the hometown honey.
Yes, the hometown honey. To having a career-ending injury if you're an athlete. To moving away from home and certainly something that we've talked about a lot, losing your identity as the brightest person in the room. So I invite people to think about all of those experiences of loss and then to think about the gifts that they offer to one another when they've encountered those moments, because I think that we have this image that death is out here and terrifying. And our friend Donovan Samer Yisrael, who's at Wellbeing at Stanford, often talks about grief as a muscle that we need to exercise. So if you can think about those other moments of loss and recognize that, one, you've been able to get through them, and two, that you understand something about some of the elements of what it means to grieve the loss of a human being. And none of us get to leave this world without losing people we love.
This is School's In with Denise Pope and Dan Schwartz. We will have more with Rabbi Patricia Carlin Newman, learning about grief and the grief cycle and how to manage it, next on Sirius XM.
This is School's In.
I'm not an expert at this. Okay. I'm more expert than you.
When you can't read in American society, you are really left out.
With Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with Rabbi Patricia Carlin Newman, who has been educating us about grief and particularly some tools for handling grief. And one question came up that I've been thinking about, which is, really, how do you tell the difference between grief and depression? Or are the two related? Because it sounds like the symptoms might look very similar.
I think that's right. And some of what goes on with grief is a lack of energy and a lack of purpose. So it can mirror depression. I think the difference is that there is a process of going through grief that slowly leads you out of it, but it can feel like waves, like you're just being overwhelmed by waves, and how quickly they come and how long the interval is between them and how large they are changes. One of the things about grief is that you could be walking along having a perfectly sensible good day, and you could smell something that will immediately take you back to this emotional welter that can be completely overwhelming. And I think the other thing that I'm not sure if it's different than depression, and I'm not a psychologist, so I wouldn't venture this, but one thing that happens with grief is that it's very hard to be able to think. So particularly for teachers, I think one thing to bear in mind, if you have students who are grieving, there are emotional and physical and cognitive and even social elements of grieving. And I often say that if you're a mourner, just getting up in the morning, taking a shower, and putting your clothes on is a victory. And we live in such a fast-paced universe where we don't even think about those things because we're on to the next thing we feel responsible for. And if you're grieving, you look around at all of the things that other people are experiencing, and they're worried at Stanford anyway, they're worried about their PSET, or they're worried about their exam or their paper. And it seems so trivial in the face of this life and death experience. So I think it can sometimes look like depression, but it may be a little bit more loss of purpose or uncertainty about whether there will ever come a time when your energy will return and the things that mattered to you previously will matter again. And we do really shift our focus, we shift our perspective when we're mourning. And some of that is enormously painful, but some of it is also helping us to recognize what's really worth engaging in our lives.
I think not knowing what to do as a friend,
right?
Or a family member or a teacher in the community.
Yeah.
What's the best advice there?
I think being willing to be present and dealing with your own anxiety around grief so that you're not placing that on the person who's a mourner. And we are so good at fixing things, especially at a place like Stanford. We're so good at being able to just kind of shove our emotions away and just do our work and put our head down. And this is one of those things that just can't be fixed. So being willing to be with someone who's lost, asking them about the person. You know, I think we sometimes fear that, I will raise this and they're not thinking about it and it'll make them sad. Well, they're thinking about it anyway. Mm. And part of what they're thinking about is how much of myself do I have to hide in order to be engaged in this moment? So that's a way to be emotionally present. I think there also are countless physical, practical things to do. You know, most religious traditions have some concept that you bring food to a mourner.
Yeah.
Part of that is so that they don't have to go through the process of going to the grocery store and cooking a meal and sitting down to eat it. And for many people who are mourners, just eating is hard.
Yeah, they're not even hungry.
Helping students who need their laundry done, arranging for them to go to a movie. For younger students, making sure that the assignments that they have are assignments that someone could talk them through if by the third time they just can't grasp what it is they were supposed to do. Mm. And being a friend. Sometimes people really appreciate normalcy. And other times there is no normalcy, and it can change from moment to moment. So it's a little crazy making. But I think taking cues from the person and saying, you know, how are you today as opposed to how are you doing? Which, you know, the answer to that is either a lie or I'm terrible.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Rabbi Patricia Carlin Newman, who's educating us about grief and particularly what you should do as someone who is a friend or a colleague, an educator or a parent to someone who's grieving. And it sounds like there's no one size fits all, which would make sense. Makes it a little harder on us. It sounds like people are going to experience this in different time frames and whatnot. So particularly because you come from a particular religious position, what do you do at Stanford with all the different rituals and all the different religions who do this in such a different way?
Yeah. Well, part of what I do is to elicit from students, what are the moments when they feel connected to the person that they've lost? And to help them to be able to enter into those moments. In some cases, it's that we used to watch a TV show together, or there's music that we like to listen to together, or we took a walk in the woods on a regular basis. So do those things. And again, back to remembering lives, keep those people in your community by doing the things that you used to enjoy doing together. One of the things that I brought with me is an article called 10 Things I Wish My Friends Knew About My Grief. And it's got some practical suggestions that I think might be helpful.
Great.
I feel just as awkward as you do, is one of them. Some sympathy cards and grief books may make me feel isolated. Right? I think we sometimes want to just hand somebody a book. That's saying, I don't really know how to be with you. I don't want to be with you, but I want you to feel better. Know that addressing what happened will not increase my pain. Recognize my decision maker is broken. Thoughtful details mean so much. And the example she uses is that she lost someone who liked different color socks, and so somebody brought socks for her. How are you today instead of how are you? Mark the anniversary on your calendar and think of me on that day.
Oh.
Let me know that you're thinking of me. I long for things to be normal, and I'm acutely aware that they aren't. Be consistent with me. Even if I don't feel like being with you, keep asking me to be with you. Just keep showing up. And the thing about grief is you never become an expert. No matter how many heartbreaking losses you've been through, sometimes even people who know this terrain recognize that they don't know exactly what to do. And being willing to live with that ambiguity and that uncertainty, and just letting people know you love them. Sometimes a hug is the most profound thing that you can say.
Right? Yeah.
I care about you. You're not alone.
You're not alone. Show up. We can do that, right, Dan?
So I had a friend who had a fatal cancer. And, you know, in the ending period, I came to visit him. He was very angry at how all his friends had treated him. And, you know, and I was there talking to him. You know, I was trying to treat him well. And I finally said to him, none of us knows what to do here.
Right.
Right. It's so ambiguous. This is not a space we've been in.
Yeah.
You know, to try and get him to have some compassion, you know, because he was struggling with it as well.
It's not easy, but I'm really glad we have people like Patricia Carlin Newman in our community. And I think the tips that we heard today, particularly for parents and educators, that it's okay to talk about it, that we should talk about it. I think people are afraid to talk about it. You know, it's the elephant in the room, but acknowledge it, show up, be there for them. This
ritual.
Is going to help. Ritual. This is going to help immensely. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Patricia. And thank all of you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app on iTunes and on SoundCloud.
From the campus of Stanford University, this has been Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.